Fan on Demand. He says the things you wish you were brave enough to say and smart enough to think of. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Monday, December the 9th, 2013, and Canada's most listened to sports talk presentation is on the air on the Sportsnet radio and television networks simultaneously. It's Primetime Sports. I'm Bob McCowan. That's Damian Cox. Later in the program, as you no doubt are aware, the Toronto Raptors made a trade finalized only about an hour or so ago. That sees Rudy Gay depart the scene and his $19 million contract.
Miss him terribly already.
The Raptors missed him terribly as they last night as they beat up on the Lakers. Or apparently they didn't miss him at all. So if this was an effort to begin the tanking process, it failed miserably.
They're going to have to all get on the same page.
Usai Majeri will join us a little bit later on, the Raptors vice president and general manager. Mixed emotions today as one of the truly great players, not just pitchers, but players in the history of the Toronto Blue Jays, has retired as a Toronto Blue Jay. He signed a one-day contract in order to do so. Here's the doc. Here's Roy Halladay. Roy, how are you? And congratulations on the retirement announcement.
Thank you, guys. I'm doing great. I appreciate it.
Whose idea was it to retire as a Blue Jay?
It really was ours. We talked about it, my wife and I, and then talked with our agency, and we really felt like it was something that was important to us. Coming up with the organization, everything they've done for me just gave me so many great opportunities that we felt like it was the right thing to do.
I mean, had this been something that, I don't know when you started thinking about retirement, but had you always been thinking, having this in the back of your mind, that's what I'd like to do?
Yeah, I definitely did. I felt like it was hard to leave Toronto. And, going to Philadelphia, I wanted to have a chance to get to the playoffs and the chance to experience that atmosphere. And I really had always kind of held out that I could do it in Toronto. And as I got older, I started to realize, this is, I'm getting older and the window's kind of getting smaller. I really need to force the issue a little bit. And that's why I felt like it was important that I needed to go then. But it just never, as much as I enjoyed my time in Philadelphia, leaving Toronto just didn't always feel 100% right. So I felt like I wanted to be able to come home, so to speak, and really acknowledge the fans and the organization and let them know how much I appreciate them.
You wouldn't know this, but there has been some conversation over the past few weeks on this program concerning the possibility of the Blue Jays either signing you or at least taking a look at you during spring training. At what point did you come to the realization that this was the time to hang them up?
I think I was kind of leaning that direction probably before the start of last season. we had talked about it, and I knew physically my time was really becoming limited, and I think after the course of the season I felt, if I really had to, I could probably go out there for a season, but it wouldn't be at the level that I wanted it to be. And I think family-wise, to make that sacrifice, it didn't make a whole lot of sense for us. I felt like I was really missing out on a lot at home. My kids are the age where they're really starting to get involved in sports and school, and things are getting serious. They're getting close to high school, and I don't want to miss these times. And I felt, to sacrifice that to go out and be average at best, and that just didn't sit very well with me. So we'd kind of been looking at it for a little while. And then I think, after talking to the doctors and looking over my back and seeing where it was and potentially what could happen if I pushed it farther, it just made a lot of sense that this was the right time.
Part of the extraordinary part of your story in Toronto, Roy, was the way it went when you were young and going all the way to the bottom and starting up and coming back and then becoming the pitcher you became. And it's funny, you know, it comes up every time a young pitcher in Toronto struggles. It came up with Ricky Romero.
Yep.
Could you go all the way back? I mean, when you look back at that segment of your career, do you look back at it fondly or as a terrible struggle or as a time really when your life turned around almost?
I look at it as, you know, in two respects, really. I don't have very comforting memories of it. It was definitely a challenge, but I also feel like it was a point where my life did kind of turn around, and I was really forced to do some things differently and kind of to search myself and figure out not only how did I want to play baseball, but what kind of person did I be? And I really had to make a lot of decisions and change a lot of things. And so it was a turning point in my life, but I think it also was a motivator the rest of my career. It's something that in the back of my mind, I used to have nightmares about it happening again. So I really did not want to do that. And I felt, you know, the best way to avoid that, being as close as I came to being out of baseball, I knew that I had to put everything I had into it every day to avoid that.
Were you, I mean, I think you may have answered the question already, but I was set to ask you, were you afraid when you went back down to Dunedin that year that your career might be over? And I guess the answer is yeah.
I definitely was. And, you know, at first I thought that maybe I could stay in the minor leagues for a little while, and if I got to a different organization, maybe I'd get a different shot. The longer I was there, I kind of really decided that, you know what, if it works, great. If it doesn't, that's fine too, but I'm going to do everything I can to make it work. And really, that's the only way I could accept myself and be comfortable with the effort I put in, was knowing that I did everything I could. And if it didn't work out, you know, I was prepared to, you know, come up with different career choices, but I felt like I really had to devote myself at that point if that's something that I wanted to do, and if it didn't work out, I was going to be okay with it, but the only way I would be okay is if I really poured my heart into it.
With Roy Halladay, who retires today as a Toronto Blue Jay, signing a one-day contract in order to do so. When you were sent down to Dunedin, now, correct me if I'm wrong. Were you here for a full 2 years or part of 2 years before you were sent down?
I was there. 99 was my first full season. 2000, I was there for most the entire season. I got sent down for a couple weeks here and there, but was pretty much there the entire season. So it was pretty much 2 years,
right.
Almost two full years. And then the next spring training, the struggles really continued, and that's when they told me what they had decided, what they wanted to do, and of course I didn't agree with it, but it worked out.
So a lot, and the story is that the change that was made was essentially changing your arm angle of your delivery. So was that it? Was that really what it took?
No, you know, I think that was actually probably one of the smaller pieces of the puzzle. For me, it was really developing the mental side of baseball. I had never failed before. I didn't know how to deal with failure. I was lacking confidence after that, and I didn't know how to rebuild that. I was basically kind of struggling at, you know, what I'd always done best my entire life and didn't know how to turn that around. So my wife happened to be walking through a bookstore. I had been talking to some other people, some baseball psychologists and stuff, and she found this book written by Harvey Dorfman, The Mental Game of Baseball. And so I started reading it, and then I found his Mental ABCs of Pitching. And come to find out, when J.P. Ricciardi came over, he had worked with Harvey in Oakland. So I asked J.P. if he knew him, and he put me in contact with him, and we established a friendship that lasted up until he passed away 2 years ago, and it made all the difference in the world for me. It really did. That, to me, that mental part was the biggest part in changing my career around. And then I think after, you know, we added the mechanical changes, that made the biggest, deal in the changes. So it was really kind of a two-part thing, but the mental part was the biggest factor in that.
Roy, you pitched over, well, the better part of two decades after your draft year. And I think in a lot of ways you define, people would see you as a workhorse pitcher, a guy you could give the ball to and go out there and give you a lot of innings. And I know my colleague Bob here talks often about his, he thinks, you know, the way in which pitching has changed, that you don't see guys pitching as many innings. I'm just wondering, over the course of your career, because it went for so long, do you see a decisive difference in starting pitching in particular between when you started and where it is now as you leave?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I first came in, the starting pitchers were expected to win the game the day they pitched. And you had a couple guys in the bullpen, you know, if things went bad, and you always had a closer, but you really didn't have these specialized relievers, you know, one to come in, face the lefty, one to face the righty, one to pitch the eighth inning, one to get that guy ready for the eighth inning. There just wasn't that depth down there. There was, you know, you had your starting pitcher, a couple guys if things went bad, and then you had your closer. I remember in Toronto thinking how lucky we were having Quantrill and Dan Plesac, and thinking, man, this is great. We got a righty and a lefty to pitch the eighth inning, and we got our closer for the ninth. This is phenomenal. And now you can't win without those guys and without a couple guys in front of them. So it definitely has changed.
Was there a time in your career where you would have said, I'd like to get the ball every fourth day rather than every fifth day?
Absolutely, yeah. And I know for a short period, that was actually brought to the table when JP was there. And we had a couple starters who really didn't feel like that was something that they could do. And so we weren't able to do it. I was pretty excited about it. And, you know, I watched the Rockies this year. They did a little bit. You know, if you're going to do it, I would still like to go out and be able to throw close to 100 pitches. You know, I think they had a 70-pitch limit. But, yeah, that would be a challenge, you know. And I think it's possible, you just cut down on your bullpens in between. I mean, so many pitchers go out and throw 50 pitches in between starts. You take those 50 pitches and put them in your start, you could, I think, easily pitch on in a four-day rotation.
Well, Nolan Ryan, recently, when he was with the Texas Rangers, of course, it suggested, as president of the Rangers, it suggested that he would have liked the Rangers to experiment with a four-man starting rotation. And, of course, I grew up in an era where that's what guys did. Every team had a four-man rotation. You pitched every fourth day. Guys, it was not unheard of for guys to pitch 250, even 300 innings in a season. And maybe mistakenly, but I've referred to the way they use pitchers today in the major leagues as babying starting pitchers. Do you think are a significant...
Absolutely.
You think there are... Go ahead.
I agree. I think, you know, you look at how, and, you know, he's a great kid, Steven Strasburg, when he came up, how they shut him down at their one shot at the playoffs was baffling to me. But I think that this is how the guys are being programmed now. There's so much money being invested in these players early on that they can't go out and really experiment with their arms and see how long they can last. They have to really protect those guys. And, you know, the one thing I've seen so much of is like I said, they have a pitch limit on every kid in the minor leagues that he can't throw over, you know, 90 or 100 pitches, but they're going to let him go throw as many pitches as he wants in that bullpen. And to me, you're not monitoring the entire pitcher if you're doing that. You're covering one end, but then you're also letting these kids abuse themselves on their own in between. So, you know, to me, you monitor that side and you let them go out and pitch as much as they possibly can. I think that's what builds arm strength. That's what builds durability. But when you're shutting these kids down at 100 pitches, limiting their innings, you're pretty much training them to pitch that way their entire career. You know, I think the more they can pitch when they're younger, the more that carries over into their career, and that's kind of how they develop.
You said earlier in this interview you left Toronto because you wanted a chance to make the playoffs. You didn't say because I wanted to win a ring. You said I wanted to make the playoffs. So now that it's over, is the career complete? Do you feel like, I mean, geez, you threw a no-hitter in the playoffs. But, I mean, do you feel you got everything you wanted, or do you feel just that one thing eluded you?
Yeah, I definitely always wanted the World Series. And I do feel like, you know, that would have been a really kind of a crowning moment for me. But, you know, like I said, the initial thought was to go there and give myself a shot at the playoffs. And at first, you know, I really felt like I needed that shot. And I felt like given that shot, you know, over a couple of years, hopefully it's with the right team, you know, things are going to work out. But they didn't. And I think, you know, as a player, you know, in 2011, we won 102 games. It was a franchise record. You know, we have one of the best starting rotations in baseball. And we caught some bad breaks. And so you realize that you really have to be in the right place at the right time. You know, it's kind of like being struck by lightning. There's not a ton that you can do to control it as much as you think there is. So it definitely would have been a great moment for me. But it's a team moment, and it's something that you have to be in the right place at the right time. There's not a lot you can do as an individual to affect that. So, you know, I tried my best. I just couldn't do it.
With Roy Halladay, one question before we let you go. Anytime a player is in your position announcing his retirement and we talk to them, we are inclined to wonder what is next and whether a continued career in another capacity in the sport is in the future. And normally I would say, Roy, with players of your skill set and level of achievement, most of those players, for whatever reason, either choose not to stay in the game or perhaps don't necessarily make the best mentors. Having said that, you went through sufficient trial and tribulation, as you documented earlier in your career, that perhaps some of the things that you assimilated when you were a young and struggling professional player might serve you well. Have you thought about a long-term future outside the game?
I have. And Alex has been kind enough, Anthopoulos, to let me come in spring training and be around the guys and be a part of things there. And then also, I told him I'd really like to be kind of a fly on the wall in the front office and see how the draft works, see how the trade deadline works, kind of learn the ins and outs of how things go on up there. You know, obviously you feel like you have an idea, but, you know, once you're actually up there, it's a whole different thing. But you're right. I mean, it definitely takes a special skill set to be a coach, to be able to teach players. So for me, it's going to be another trial and error. I'm going to get involved with as many things as I can and kind of see what sticks and what works for me. But I would definitely love to be a part of the game and somehow give back everything that's been given to me.
Well, that's exciting news for everybody. We wish you the best of luck with that. And now, given that knowledge, we'll look forward to seeing you in Dunedin in the spring.
Sounds good. Look forward to being there.
Congratulations again on a tremendous career. And on behalf of everybody here, and not just in Toronto, but as you know, this is Canada's team in this country listening and watching to this program. Thank you for a lot of great afternoons and evenings at the Ball Yard.
Well, thank you. And thank you to the fans, too. They've meant a lot in my life and meant a lot to my family. So We really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Doc. Best to you and the family, and we'll see you in February.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Roy Halladay retires as a member of the Toronto Blue Jays with aspirations. Will go to spring training and will assist in coaching, but will also hang around Alex Anthopoulos in the front office and, I guess, trying to figure out whether there's a role for him either on the field after now that his career is over or off the field.
I don't know, Bob. Based on that interview, I mean, I was one of the best interviews I've ever heard him give.
No, the best.
Maybe broadcasting might be what he should look at. I've never heard Roy Halladay open up and discuss his career and trials and tribulations and everything about baseball and have thoughts on the game. I mean, he was a pretty controlled guy.
Intense.
With the media in particular. Yep. And so to hear him talk like that was... Boy, that was a real pleasure. That was really interesting to listen to him.
Hear, hear. We wish him the best luck. And that is most fascinating news regarding his future.
That Anthopoulos guy, you got to watch him all the time.
Sneaky little devil. The general manager of the Toronto Raptors, Usai Majuri, joins us on the telephone. Well, what's new?
What's going on, guys?
Well, we're just waiting for the official announcement, and I gather it happened within the last couple of hours.
Yes.
The deal has been consummated, was involving Rudy Gay. At the net result, maybe you can just run us through the guys that are involved here. Were there any changes, last-minute changes?
No, Rudy Gay, Quincy Acey, Aaron Gray for Grievous Vasquez. Salmons, Hayes, and Patterson.
Give us an idea, Masai, of how this deal was consummated. The last time we talked to you, we talked in generalities about the middle of December or somewhere around there, and I guess technically we're getting close to that, in how the deal, in how you were going to proceed, when you were going to make a decision. Did you kind of move things up? Was there interest from other teams? How did the conversation begin?
You know, with these things, you just I think you go on information that you've gathered before, and we were not playing very well, and you get a couple calls here and there, and it just that's the NBA. It just leads to one thing or the other. I was just saying at the press conference, I came in yesterday on Sunday to do a 1 o'clock in the afternoon to do a Mandela interview, and I ended up staying here for 9 hours because of this. But it just comes, you know, like I,
right.
It's not planned or and you know, Sacramento had showed interest in the summer, and we just got back to talking, and it was easy to do a deal with a guy I've worked with that we worked together in Denver. So that I think that helped a lot. So yeah, it's gone on, and these things sometimes there's no build up because it totally goes dead and there's nothing, and then there's small conversation. And I came in here yesterday at one thinking there was basically like nothing, and it all came down to we made a deal.
Well, I was going to say, Masai, I mean, there were no shortage, and I'm sure you heard it, lots of people who said, there's no chance he can trade Rudy Gay. There's just no way, or at least not trade him in a deal that will do anything but bring back more contracts that would be difficult to have to deal with. But that didn't turn out to be the case. Did you always believe that there would ultimately be a trade that would be a solution for you, or were you not sure?
We have to try, you know, like it's not like you go there and you're like desperately looking. I think you have to figure it out, you know, like it's and it's our job to do that. That's why we're put in this position to do this job, and you keep trying, you know, like to work generally to try and make your organization better and think long term, and that's what we're doing. But yeah, was it difficult to do? Yes, it's probably one of the most difficult ones I've had to figure out. But yeah, we as a front office, I think we the tough part of it all, honestly, guys, is that option. You know, like that option, you know, really like gives you some degree of uncertainty or plenty degree of uncertainty, because is he going to opt out? Is he going to opt in? You know, like, and then you're not playing well enough where you can kind of start having conversations about something for the future, you know, like, so it puts you in a very tough spot, you know, like, it's quite a substantial amount of money. So generally, like, very tough to do, but we got through it. And I tell you what, Rudy is a unbelievable professional, great person. And basketball-wise, we just didn't have any sync and it didn't work out. But he was tremendous, I think, for us in a lot of other ways and other senses.
Every trade is different. But if you were to compare the two, was this a more difficult trade to make than the Carmelo Anthony trade, or is it? Could you compare them?
I think, you know, I walked into my house yesterday after gone for like 8 or 9 hours, and I told my wife, I think this one was the most difficult, because you are. You know, but I don't like to talk about the Carmelo deal, because it's done and gone and we've all moved on. But, you know, like that had me, you know, like a lot of attention around it, and you can kind of see it build up, and you knew something was going to happen. You know, like with this one, like I said, there's uncertainty, and it's not like, it's also not like we were planning and looking. We looked at our team and we're evaluating our team, and then we saw that it wasn't quite going to, you know, like work out, and it wasn't working out on the basketball front. So I think this one was a little bit more difficult.
With Masai Ujiri, the general manager of the Toronto Raptors, Rudy Gay being traded, the confirmation of the deal just a few hours ago. Bluntly, Masai, there were many people that observed Rudy Gay, at least in this situation, and said too often the ball stops when it gets to Rudy. Was that part of the concern that you had as you observed what was going on with your team and motivated you to consummate this deal?
We didn't have any sync, you know. Like, I don't want to say the ball, you know, that's observation from different people, and everybody has their...
Fair enough.
Yes, has their point of view. I think that's very fair, but... We just didn't have any, whether he held the ball or not, we didn't have any sync, you know, like there was no chemistry. It wasn't fun watching us out there, you know, and there was no flow to our game. There was no flow to the style of play or what we were doing, you know, and it was, you know, like, I know it's frustrating a little bit, even if you are not a very good team, you know, like at least there should be a sense of, you know, purpose of what you are doing, you know, and we just looked like we were stagnant. Our spacing wasn't that great. So I think there had to be change. There was no sink there. And we had to make a change.
So Rudy doesn't play against the Lakers. A bunch of the guys don't play against the Lakers, and you go out and beat the Lakers in L.A. just for the record, can you explain that, please?
Well, we're going to be world champs now. No, you know, sometimes with these things, you know, like it's, I think it's the momentum, right? Of I knew, you know, George Karl always used to, every time a player was coming back, you know, like to, from injury, you know, like how Kobe did. George Karl would guarantee me that we were going to win that game. You know, like, you tell me, we're winning. We'll win this one. You know, like, it was weird how he knew, and how, because he felt like a player coming back would kind of get those guys out of sync a little bit, even if it was a great player, or they kind of have to react a little bit to the guy coming back. And, you know, like, we did move the ball. I think we played with great energy yesterday, and it was fun. It was fun to watch, and I'm not saying it's because the one player was here or Rudy was there or not there. You know, like, I think the momentum of Kobe coming back, and those guys were playing on a big stage. Everybody gets pumped up to play in L.A., you know, like, so, and they pulled it off. I think they reacted well.
So everywhere you go today, when there's a report about the Rudy Gay trade, it's what the trade is, and then the next paragraph is, the tank has begun.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that as a competitive guy, as a general manager?
It's tough, you know, like because you want to you want to go out there and compete. The reason why you go there and you put a basketball team on the floor is because you want to win. You know, like I don't. It's like yesterday you wanted to win. You know, like but I completely understand, guys. You know, I understand the perspective. I understand big picture and. We understand here that we're not going to do anything funny that's going to put us in a position that hurts the future of our organization. That I think that comes first. And the one thing I've said, you know, and I'm going to say it again, we don't want to be caught in no man's land, and we're going to figure it out, you know, like be it get better or figure out our team for the future. But we're not going to be caught in no man's land.
One last question before we let you go, Masai. We would be remiss if we didn't give you a moment to perhaps convey what Nelson Mandela meant to you, his passing last week. Of course, didn't come as a great shock. We knew he hadn't been well. It had been a long time since we'd seen him in public. He was, after all, 95, I believe, years old. Take a minute, if you can or will, and tell us what his life meant to you.
You guys don't know. I really appreciate you doing this. It's for me, you know, I was driving home when I heard, the NBA gave me. I said it in the press conference, but I'll say it again. The NBA gave me an unbelievable opportunity to go do Basketball Without Borders for the last 12 years. Be the director of the camp, and through that I got a special bond with South Africa, and it's almost it's a close country to me, and I met Nelson Mandela twice, and what an unbelievable feeling when you meet this man. It gives you goosebumps, and but he is Father Africa. He paved the way for us. When I met him, he came over, it was about five of us, he came over to Mutombo and said what a great thing you are doing with the hospital you built, and he looked at me and he said what a great smile you have, and young man, and that has always, you know, like stuck with me. But reconciliation, equality, and giving people a sense of hope. I'm proud to have known him, and I know he put Africa in a good path, and hopefully we all can come together and figure out a way to get better on the continent. But what a great man.
Beautifully said. Thank you very much, as always, for your time today, Masai. We appreciate it, and we'll talk soon, I hope.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Damian. I appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Masai Ujiri, the general manager of the Toronto Raptors. We'll take a break and back with more. Now 27 minutes before the hour. Primetime continues on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Cooler than Math Club and almost as cool as Chess Club. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
After midnight.
Some 19 minutes before the hour. Bob McCowan, that's Damian Cox. Time now for the unnamed segment where Damian gets to ask questions. How exciting for me. Carry on, young man.
How do you feel about Ohio State now?
Go Buckeyes.
Notre Dame beat Michigan State.
It happens.
That's embarrassing.
It happens.
Well, do you have an explanation for this?
None. They were life and death to beat Michigan.
I have one, and it goes like this.
Well, let's be careful, because they won 23 in a row.
Sheesh.
That's a pretty good run. I may be wrong by a game or two. No, it was 20. They hadn't lost under that new coach.
All I can tell you, they fared better than Duke. I'll give you that. They did better than Duke against Florida State.
Oh, well.
I'll give you that.
Thank you.
Now, we haven't talked a lot of hockey today. Well, we did. We had the two boys in for a while. But we were talking mostly Olympic hockey. Last night, Toronto Maple Leafs lose to the Boston Bruins 5-2.
Yes,
and in this game,
yes, sir,
the captain of the Maple Leafs, Dion Phaneuf, gets unsigned himself into a little bit. Tell me, I want to know, and for those of you watching at home, I want to know what you think of this hit here.
Okay, we're going to watch this hit for those of you watching.
This is Dion Phaneuf on Kevin Miller, the
roll it.
The Boston
here he comes.
Rookie.
Boom.
Now, no penalty on the play. Phaneuf has a hearing, a phone hearing, with Brendan Shanahan tomorrow, which means he can't get any more than five games. Now, four Maple Leafs have already been suspended this year. This would be the fifth. What do you think of that hit?
I think you have to be held responsible for your actions. I think a penalty was warranted and wasn't called, right? There was no penalty called.
No penalty.
I think a penalty was warranted. But the way, if you watch the way Phaneuf approaches him, it almost looks like at the last second he changes his mind on where to hit him and how to hit him. And I wouldn't suspend him. But I think he'll probably get a game or two. But I wouldn't give him a game. I don't think it was a suspendable offense. I think it should have been a penalty. It should have been a boarding penalty. But I don't see malice aforethought there.
There is no penalty called with more inconsistency in the National Hockey League than the hitting from behind.
Yeah.
How can a hitting from behind penalty ever be a minor? I just don't understand it. So,
like, if you give
them, I'm okay if they give them whatever they give them. The problem is, I see that hit.
Every night.
Every night.
Every night you see that hit. Yep. I know. I mean, look, at part of me, you know how I feel about this stuff. Part of me says, give him life imprisonment.
But if you're not giving life imprisonment, how do you give life imprisonment?
I mean, that's not by far, that wasn't the worst hit of the weekend.
Might not have been the worst hit in that game.
It might not have been the worst hit in the game.
James Neal gets five games today for kneeing Brad Marchand in the head. Do you see that hit?
Yes.
Did he do it deliberately?
100%.
1,000%.
1,000% deliberately.
I don't know how he gets only five.
I don't know either.
I mean, he so obviously skated right into Marchand's head. Now, I will tell you this. There are approximately 100 NHLers who would like to do that and skate into his head, but it led to this part now, and that was the Sean Thornton assault on Brooks Orpik. So if Neal gets five, now Thornton ostensibly was reacting to another hit, Orpik on Louis Erickson.
Doesn't matter.
Knock Louis Erickson. Sean Thornton, just for the record, as far as we go with enforcers in the game, is one of the more honest enforcers. But what does he get for this little bit of mayhem?
Well, that was an ambush. He came at him from behind. Orpik didn't see him coming. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. In the current
You're
environment,
really struggling with everything. These
well, days. I'm struggling. I struggle with what the right response is. Am I supposed to respond based on what I think Shanahan will give him, or am I supposed to respond based on what I think he should get? And what I think, and am I supposed to evaluate what I would give him based on the environment that currently exists in the NHL,
right,
which is this precedent nonsense,
right,
BS?
Right.
Or are you trying, if you're trying to get rid of this stuff, there were two plays right there that should have been, that in my view are max penalties, whatever the max is. One of them has been adjudicated, the hit to the head, and we got five games out of it. The Thornton thing, is it worse? It's every bit as bad. It may be worse, but five games is insufficient for either of those two hits, in my opinion.
I agree with that. I'm with you on that.
But I don't know what the number is.
There doesn't seem to be, and I've spoken to Brendan Shanahan many times on this, and there is not, what they're missing in this league is they don't seem to want to penalize to the extent to make sure it doesn't ever happen again. What changed?
But that's
what changed Matt Cook?
A big-ass suspension.
A humongous suspension. And he said, you know what? I think I need to change my ways.
Yeah. Hang on a sec. Yeah. Perhaps this is not a good
idea. Let me have another look at this.
Mm-hmm.
This is more than a one gamer.
But it's societal, you know, again, if you, I said this 100 million times. A punishment is supposed to act as a deterrent. A deterrent only works if you don't want to do it again because you know what it's going to cost you. So, do we know how many games you have to be suspended in order for the message to get through? We don't. But here's what we do know. The suspensions that are currently being handed out are not enough. How far do you have to go beyond that? I don't pretend to know. 10, 15, 20, 50, life, death penalty? Don't know. It's somewhere in there.
Somewhere between nothing and the death penalty.
Yes, we have to find that number. And the National Hockey League is refusing to organize a search party and find out what that number is. They're stuck on 5, 3, 2. These do not work. These are irrelevant numbers. These penalties do not work.
Well said, Bob. How much time we got?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Hey, a question for you on those. Did you watch Philadelphia and Detroit yesterday in the NFL?
I watched highlights of the Snow Bowl.
Is there ever too much snow to allow a playoff game? I mean, they will stop a game for a number of things. Is there ever too much snow?
You and I did not grow up together.
Thank
God. As a young man, did you ever, usually upon that first early snowfall, so when football season is still on, and you and your pals take the ball Sunday afternoon and go over to the football field or maybe on the back grass or whatever, and you're still, you know, you're still playing touch football, okay? And then you get that snow.
Oh, it's wonderful.
There is nothing better than playing touch football in the snow.
It was automatic. My brother Don and I, we'd call the Rosenthals, Gary and Kenny, come over. We'd play 2-on-2 in the snow.
100%. What my favorite thing to do in the entire world is to play touch football in the snow.
And that's all great. But that's not what I asked.
No. But then what inevitably happens is this conversation. Do you think we could play tackle?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure it's tackle.
Yeah, because
it's landing. You don't even need equipment.
No. Just soft landing. That was fantastic.
It was interesting.
And everybody's puzzled by the number of points they scored. People, go try and play defense.
Try to defend.
Try to defend on a field that's got snow this deep on it and is slippery underneath. The guy who's with the ball, he has an idea where he's going to go. You don't. You have to react. Well, you can't react if your ass is on the ground sliding across the turf. And that's what was happening yesterday. I'm surprised they didn't score 200 points.
I got time for one more?
Yeah, you do.
Give me an over-under how long Robinson Cano lasts in Seattle before A, he wants out, or B, they want him out. My number, just so you know, reference, 3 seasons. And I might take the under.
Really, huh?
I might take the under. It's a nasty situation out there with Seattle with ownership, and it's awful stuff going on. Why he signed there is money.
No, we know.
$65 million more than the Yankees were offering.
That's money.
65.
See, now he's got the contract. The question now is, will somebody else be desperate enough at some point in time?
Yes.
To want to acquire that contract? Yes. And the answer is invariably yes.
So over under is
stupidity among owners is a contagious thing. Apparently.
Are you taking the over or the under?
I like 3. 3 is a nice number. I that sounds about right to me. 3 years and adios muchachos. And it'll be probably because they will realize we really can't pay this guy this much money.
What were we thinking?
Like, I'm not sure Cano will want out as much as the Seattle will say.
We're paying him what?
And he's a second baseman. And he's very nice, and he plays well, but...
And we're not anywhere close to the playoffs.
But this is stupid. Unfortunately, Hicks doesn't own a baseball team anymore, so he probably won't take him off his
Send him back to the Yankees. Send him back to the Yankees.
Seattle's had some great players, and the inevitability is they leave. There's a long list.
Mm-hmm.
Griffey Jr., adios. A-Rod?
Gone.
Adios. Those are two pretty big names. They had that Randy Johnson guy for a while, too,
yes,
didn't
they?
Did. And then he left. Mm-hmm. Robinson Cano. Get it while you're hot, because baby, you'll be cold for a long, long time. See you tomorrow.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca.